Genesis chapter 22. Genesis 22, we began this last week. Such a critical chapter, not just for the book of Genesis, but for the entire Bible, and the message being presented here, the figure that is presented in Genesis 22 is absolutely staggering as far as the detailed illustration of God's love and the detailed illustration of the scheme of redemption and the only begotten Son to be the sacrifice by which the Lord will provide for Himself unto us, for us. So we're looking at a lot of these similarities, very clear similarities here in the text. This isn't something that we have to, try to wander away and, try to pull some sort of connection here and there or anything, any kind of weird connection. Everything is presented in such a way where we know exactly what's going on and the intent of God here in showing His scheme of redemption before speaking once again about the covenant that He has made with Abraham. And the covenant that He's talking about is concerning the coming of the Lord, is concerning salvation unto all nations. And so this, what we have Abraham doing here, this this role that he takes in this chapter with a father and son, and the father sacrificing his only begotten son, is certainly a foreshadowing of what God is doing, going to do, and what He has promised Abraham that He would do. So we've looked here at the first several verses, and I think we're in verse 5. Yes, we are in verse 5. So Abraham is being tested, if we remember what's going on here. His faith is being tested. He's being presented with a situation before him that is, number one, it's challenging. Number two, it has an appearance that it goes against the promises of God. It has an appearance that it goes against what is right. And so these things very often will cause us in our life to stop and to turn and to fail the test possibly, but with Abraham we see that the appearance of the situation, although this seems so against what God has promised about Isaac and the sacrifice here of Isaac, we see that he wholeheartedly trusts in God, and so he passes the test, so to speak. And it's of course the test is for him. It's for him to better understand his faith, and it's for him to grow and these kinds of things. But nevertheless, this is something that is so important for us when we see that he is being tested in this way, and that we need to be conscious of this in our lives. And things that come in our path. A lot of times, people just justify things. I'm not going to, choose to serve God in this way because maybe this is too hard. Whatever before me is just too hard. It's too much to ask. Or maybe number two, they think this doesn't appear to be in accordance with God's word or God's promises. And I made that example last week about the people who walk away from the church, fall away from the church, because they had this sense of appearance about how life would be as a Christian. Life would be as a child of God. They had these ideas of what blessings they would get. And, you know, as maybe their life started crumbling and, you know, bad things were going on with their life, that there are so many that they fall away from the Lord because of those very things. So you look at your life and, you know, it has this appearance that is not your vision of how it ought to appear. And that is not a reason. That is not a justifiable reason to say, okay, then I'm not going to, you know, follow God then. You know, he's not doing anything for me. I'm not, you know, I'm not going to do anything for him. So it's of no benefit to me to continue to worship God or serve God. So that's definitely a prevalent cause for individuals who fall away. And so you see with Abraham here, his faith is just rock solid in how he is fully trusting in God, even though everything around in this situation appears to be really pretty horrific. So we see in verse 4, on the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place afar off. As they're coming to the mount, it's been 3 days now. In verse 5, Abraham said to his young men, "Stay here with the donkey. The lad and I will go yonder and worship, and we will come back to you." So this is a critical statement, and I really want to pair this with what the writer of Hebrews tells us, Hebrews chapter 11, because I think that really gives us the full picture. It gives us that inner perspective of Abraham's mind, and we don't have that in Genesis 2. We don't hear very much out of Abraham. We definitely don't hear we hear nothing about what he's thinking, you know, throughout these days. But Hebrews 11, the Holy Spirit lets us know what he's been thinking. And so I want to continue. I know we paired that last week. I want to continue to pair that Hebrews 11 with this text, so that we do have full understanding of it and what's going on. So what do we see there in Hebrews 11? But in verse 17, "By faith Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promise offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, 'In Isaac your seed shall be called,' concluding that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from which he also received him in a figurative sense." So in Abraham's mind, how does this the appearance of the situation ahead of him of sacrificing his son, how does that pair with the promise God has already given him, which was, "In Isaac your seed would be called"? How could the seed be called in Isaac if Isaac is sacrificed? He's, you know, he's gone. Well, in Abraham's thinking, notice the trust that he has in God here. Not just the trust in the promise, but also the trust in God's ability and God's power. So there's several layers here to the faith of Abraham. He is keeping in mind the promise of God. It's not something that he's just forgotten or thinks that God has forgotten. He believes that God has remembered the promise. God knows the promise. And then there is the other layer of his faith where he recognizes that God is able. So even though God has asked him to give up his only begotten son as a sacrifice, Abraham realizes that God is able to raise him up again in order that that promise would be fulfilled. So you see it's multifaceted, the views of the trusts that Abraham has in God in this text. So when you see verse 5 back in Genesis 22, and you see him in verse 5 saying to the young men who were traveling with them, stay here with the donkey, the lad and I will go yonder and worship, and we will come back to you. We know what he has in mind here. We know this isn't something that this isn't, you know, one of those fibs of Abraham. This is not something that he is attempting to deceive these young men that they're traveling with. But he does know this is a statement of faith. This is a statement of confident assurance and trust in God for him to say here, we're going to go and worship and we will come back to you. So, again, statement of faith, not a lie, not a deception. What do we read in Hebrews 11? He knew that God was able. And so that they would come back. He knew the promise had to be fulfilled. In order for that promise to be fulfilled, they would have to both come back from the mountain. So he knew that was going to happen. So him saying this to these men is certainly not a deception, but it was a confession of his faith in God. In verse 6, it says, so Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son, and he took the fire in his hand and a knife, and the two of them went together. But Isaac spoke to Abraham his father and said, my father. And he said, here I am, my son. And he said, look, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? And Abraham said, my son, God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering. So the two of them went together. Now, looking at this again, you know, it's interesting as we have Abraham and Isaac, father and only begotten son, the father and the unique son, and the father and the son of promise. And this is, you know, all foreshadowing, of course, of God in heaven and the unique son of God, the only begotten son. The son of promise, the seed by which all the nations of the earth would be blessed with salvation. And you have that picture, and you notice that Isaac, you know, carrying the wood up to the mountain, you know, which we talked about already. This is the land of Moriah. So these are the mountains that much later on, you know, it doesn't seem to be anything right now, but much later on, these are going to be the hills and the mountains by which Jerusalem would be built upon and encompassed around. And one of these mountains would later be known as Mount Zion. This would be where the temple would be built. Go ahead. Yahweh is the provider. Well, that's probably right. I don't know. I didn't look that up. So that's interesting. I know later, Abraham call the place specifically? The Lord will provide. There in verse 14. Where's that at? Yeah, verse 14. The Lord will provide. So maybe that's a reference there as well. So that's interesting. So, you know, this is the region. This is the mountain, like you're saying, Mount Moriah. This is where God provides, and this is the area where it all takes place and it all goes down. And so I can't help but find it just incredibly fascinating that you know, God could have told Abraham to go and do this anywhere, but he has him travel a three-day journey, mind you. 3 days, he has him travel 3 days to this area where salvation will, this is where it's going to begin. And, you know, Jesus specifically said, you know, that it would begin in Jerusalem, you know, and then in all Judea, and then to the ends of the earth. And so it's just all the connections here to the text and God's plan of redemption. God is just painting this incredible picture here of His foresight, you know, and His predetermined knowledge of this is what is going to happen, and even in this place, in this locale. So, and notice Isaac, he's going up the mountain, and he's carrying the wood. You know, he's carrying the wood for his own sacrifice, and you know, it's a similar connection to Jesus. You know, carrying his wood up the mount, out of Jerusalem, and up you know, the hill or what have you. So Isaac is carrying the wood, and Isaac says, here's all the supplies, but where is the lamb? Where's the lamb for the burnt offering? And Abraham says, God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering. Tremendous. God will provide for himself the lamb. And so once again, we see Abraham here, while obviously he doesn't know or understand everything or exactly how everything is about to take place. What he recognizes here is that he and Isaac are entirely in God's hands, and Abraham has placed himself there in full trust of what is happening and what is going to happen. So, verse 9, then they came to the place of which God had told him, and Abraham built an altar there and placed the wood in order, and he bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar upon the wood. And Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. So he said, Here I am. And he said, Do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. So we see that Abraham, of course, he's going to go through this. You look at Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11 tells us flat out that Abraham is going to follow through with this because Abraham's faith was in that God was able to raise Isaac back up from the dead. And so he certainly was going to go through with it. And the angel of the Lord stops him right there as it's all about to happen. And, you know, that's where Hebrews comes in and says that, you know, God was able to raise him up. That's what Abraham believed. And it says, and, you know, Abraham, figuratively, that's exactly what Abraham got out of it. Abraham saw the resurrection of his son in a figurative sense, you know, obviously not literal because of Isaac, his blood was not shed. But to Abraham's mind, when God told him to give your only begotten son, Abraham's mind from that moment to day one, to day two, to 3 days, his son is dead. As they traveled, his son's dead. That is the faith of Abraham. That's what's going to happen. And then on day three, here we are on the Mount of Deliverance, and his son is raised up. He's resurrected in a figurative sense. So it's when you pair this with Hebrews 11, it's really profound to see the maturity of Abraham's faith at this time in his life, that when God says something, it's as good as done right there. And hopefully we'll be able to see a little bit more of that if we have time as we go through here today. Hebrews points on this. I'll throw a little bit out there. You know, it talks about how Abraham was looking for the city, you know, looking for the city that has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. When God says something to Abraham, that's it, you know, and it is the absolute reality from that moment that it's said. That's the reality. And it doesn't matter that it hasn't come yet. It doesn't matter that Abraham lived the rest of his life and he died never seeing the city of God, you know, never seeing those promises fulfilled. He never saw that great nation that God promised him. He never saw the coming of salvation. He never saw the church. You know, all these things that were, these were the promises made to him. But you see how Hebrews illustrates Abraham as it was absolute. From the moment God says it, it is absolute. And it's just, he's really, really a good example for us in when we're wanting to understand what is my faith supposed to be like, you know? What's it supposed to look like? So, let's see here. Where are we at? Oh, okay, so the angel stops him. Notice what the angel says to him in verse 12. Do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, because you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. So look at that statement there. I think that's a fascinating statement. You know, the word fear hasn't come into the picture, into the context at all thus far. But the angel's response here is, you have shown to heaven and earth. And you have, you know, he still is showing us to this day as we're reading. You have shown, you know, that you fear God. And to look at this statement and then look at everything that has happened here in this chapter, in this test, Abraham's test, and to recognize that out of the angel's mouth, he is describing this situation as Abraham fears God. You know, that's what he says. That's what he says. So, you know, that's kind of, you know, the title, you know, to the story, if you will. You know, of course, people put a lot of different titles on this story. You know, Abraham offers up Isaac. Abraham's tested. Abraham's faith is confirmed, or whatever the title they give. But out of the angel's mouth, you see what he says. Abraham fears God. You know, I think that should be really the title, if we're going to put a title to the story. Abraham fears God. And that's what happens. That's what we're seeing. And we're getting a picture of what it is, what it means to fear God. And I don't, yes, go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead. Yeah. Fear God and keep His commandments, for that is the all. That is the all of man, all of life. That is the great purpose of life. And this is what we have seen out of Abraham. Excellent point. I don't know if fear. I didn't look. You know, if the concept or idea of fear has come up yet. You know, in the record. But when we see a statement like this, we realize, because you and I have both read this text, and you don't see a shivering, trembling, you know, Abraham. You see a confident Abraham who confesses his God and confesses his faith here in more ways than one. I believe both with the mouth as well as with his action. And, you know, here we're only 22 chapters into the Bible, if you will. And what are we learning about faith, or fear rather? Abraham is labeled here with one who fears God, and we have seen him as one who, in his dealings with God, is a friend, you know, he is able to talk with God, and he's able to trust him. And when we think of fear, you fear somebody. Well, that's usually the very same person that you have no trust. You know, you don't trust them at all. You know, I'm afraid of that person. You know, that basically means I don't trust them one bit. In fact, I trust opposite. I trust that, you know, if I have more dealings with them, it's not going to be good. I'm afraid of them. So you see, with the fear of God is different. Which isn't this what the psalmist said in Psalm 19? The fear of the Lord is clean. You know, it is not that kind of dirty, spotted, you know, blemished fear. It is not a fear that is just muddied up with the evils of men and the wickedness. I mean, that's why people fear other peoples, because they're wicked, you know, people. They're vile people, and you know, you don't believe they're going to be good by you, you know, and you know you're not going to find peace with them, and that's why people fear other people or fear other nations or fear other groups, because those people are tainted, you know, and covered and spotted with evil. But the fear of the Lord is clean. God is light, and there's no spot. There's no element of darkness. There's no element of guile. There's no deceit. There's no evil to be found in Him, only good. And so the fear of the Lord is clean. This is a totally different concept of fear than, you know, being afraid of somebody, being afraid of what evils they would do. What God does is good, and what God does is just. And so, you know, the fear of God, some might define it as, you know, reverence, you know, deep-seated reverence and honor and respect and these kinds of things. And I think that certainly is a pretty good definition of what's going on here. But really, it's almost a little difficult to put into words. But because what we saw, the fear, is in the mind and the action here of Abraham. His God telling him to do something, and him wholeheartedly honoring God in this, and trusting. And as I said, there's many elements here, I believe, to this fear. And so I hate to just walk away with this and say, you know, the angel says, "Now I know that you fear God," and say, he respects God. I mean, it's really a pretty deep text as far as what this fear really is.
So the idea of fear for the believer is what you've been saying, but the idea for the unbelievers who are not, or who are against God, then what Jesus said to the Pharisees would apply: fear not the one who can destroy your body, mm-hmm. fear the one that can destroy your body and throw your soul into Hades.
And absolutely, and we all have to recognize that when it comes to the fear, is that we recognize the goodness of God and also the justice of God, and that's what Paul warned the Romans with when he said, "Consider the goodness and severity of God." He said on those who who believed, you know, was God's goodness was upon them. But those who did not, there was, you know, they faced severity from God. And God is just, and so we do need to recognize that we're not buddy-buddy, you know. He is our God, and He is our Creator. And so, you know, looking at this, fear, as I said, it's not a... You just can't put a single definition to it. You can't... I don't think you can really describe it too well in one sentence, but I think the Bible, through and through, just colorfully illustrates the kind of people and picking them out and saying, look at this. This is how you fear God. This is what it looks like. And you know, that's how God deals with so many subject matters of us. You know, faith is another one, you know, which faith and fear, they go hand in hand. But you know, this is what faith looks like. So so now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. And then notice in verse 13, Abraham lifted his eyes and looked, and there behind him was a ram caught in a thicket by its horns. So Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up for a burnt offering instead of his son. And Abraham called the name of the place, "The Lord will provide." For it is said to this day, "In the mount of the Lord it shall be provided." And I love this idea, not the mount of the Lord, it shall be provided, as in something to come, right? In the mount of the Lord it was provided, you know, or like a past tense, you know, this happened to Abraham. No, in the mount of the Lord it will be provided. And so it's a prophetic statement here, and the name of this place is a prophetic name of something greater to come. And you notice that something greater was definitely to come, because what did Abraham say after all? He said, God will provide the lamb. And the lamb was yet to be seen in the text, right? The ram, you know, there was the ram. But, you know, what of necessarily this lamb in reference? I don't know. But at any rate, whatever the case is, you know, whether we can quibble about these animals and, you know, exactly all of that, but the fact is, this is prophetic, and Abraham calling the name of this place is prophetic, that not only did God provide there on that day, but He is going to provide and always will provide the sacrifice for us. Do you have a comment? Yeah, good point.
About his trust in his father when he told him that the Lord would provide an offering for him. And over in Hebrews, we talk about he received him back in our figurative sense. He did. In Abraham's mind, he was sacrificed.
Yeah.
He done everything the Lord told him to do. When he lifted that knife, he was sacrificed. He did receive him back. He says in the figurative sense, he received him back from the altar. He put him on an altar. But going back to Isaac, just back to that last chapter, we don't really know because the last few verses of chapter 21 told us that Ishmael had grown and became an archer in the land and was old enough that he took a wife. Well, we do know that Ishmael was 14 years older than Isaac, so Isaac had to be probably 10, 12, somewhere in that. But
yeah.
The thing about it is, his trust in his father when he told him, he could have turned right. I mean, but he willingly, his father took him, bound him hand and feet, and laid him on an altar.
Yeah.
So I think you got to give Isaac a lot of credit.
Sure. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I agree. It's the whole thing is tremendous. So there's the ram is offered and the place is named. And then notice what happens here in verse 15. It says, then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time out of heaven and said, by myself I have sworn, says the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, blessing I will bless you, and multiplying I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heaven and as the sand which is on the seashore, and your descendants shall possess the gate of their enemies. In your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed because you have obeyed my voice. So Abraham returned to his young men, and they arose and went together to Beersheba, and Abraham dwelt at Beersheba. So we have a restatement here, a restating of the promises that God had previously made to Abraham. But notice something interesting here, where God is saying, because you have done this thing, because you have done this, because you have not withheld your son, your only son. We see that all things, you know, were pretty well contingent. Abraham's salvation and the nation's salvation later on was going to be contingent upon faith. That's where old Israel failed and were destroyed many, many times. It's because they did not have what Abraham has here.